this week. Sweet. Oh, that's not this week.
You are now recording.
I agree.
How did you do that? You should show me how to do that.
My glasses.
Which
have,
one is it?
I have no idea.
I have to figure that out.
I just went to file and pushed record and started recording. So
I pushed record and it didn't record.
You need a special touch.
I frequently don't have a special touch. All right, we'll get going. Courtesy to everybody who is here.
Do you want a sign-in sheet?
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Thank you, Mark. Deb and I sat down. We tried to compile out of, like, notes, the public input night, ideas that we floated around the table at CJATI, and a continuing request from the people in the trenches. And if you think of something, had a dream, if we only had such and such, which is still something I think, Mark, we need to do with the magistrates. What could we have that might produce a better outcome? So Deb did it in an Excel sheet, and I Xeroxed. You got yours?
Yeah.
And I think I have yours. Hey, Marcia. We got it on, believe me.
You did.
It took a million of us, but we got it.
And the little bars are going up and down, right?
Not up and down, they're going across.
You better check your machines.
Whatever.
You seem to have the touch for it. This is Deb's. I ran copies.
Is it working?
See if the timer is going. Okay.
I will let you know when the meeting is. Yes.
Because I have to share it with close to each other. I don't have these for everybody.
I noticed that the fiscal impact is to be shifted down one.
Yeah, and that is kind of a guesstimate.
Totally.
And we're not really there yet, but we need to figure out what. Did everybody get a copy? Do we need more copies? Joe, did you get
one? One.
And then I went through, and one thing that I did put at the top was some of the things that we set out as our guidelines in the beginning, and I thought it was just a good time for a reminder as we go through now and we're talking about stuff. Like what's within the court's jurisdiction, what can we influence, alternatives and resources, things that can be added to what we already have, things that can be tweaked, and I think we need to do long-term, short-term, which Deb kind of set out.
Yeah, but this is off the top of my head.
Right. I mean, this is just very cursory. It's just a draft, kind of putting the ideas together, trying to at least compile, all the different things we've talked about and all the different things we've heard.
Susie, do you have any more of these?
I have mine. I copied a bunch. They must be coming around.
Which ones? They're stuck right there.
Angela, I'll take some of those.
I got stuck. Yep, sorry, Beth. I'm hogging them all. I think, did this one go this way?
I just need one.
I think Bill needs one.
I think that there's a bunch, and Bill
Shoveled
one off.
Do you got one?
As long as things are coming around, can I start the ACT team?
Right.
Is there another one?
There's just two handouts.
I have four already.
Well, then you probably have
too
much.
They seem to be different from each other.
What is this?
From Linda's office.
Who's remember our guidelines from?
Me.
It's from you. Okay.
It's from Linda.
Act from Linda.
I've got that here.
And I find it's very helpful to put things at the top. Who you got it from, when.
And if anybody has this Albany County TASC thing, that's from me.
Okay, I don't have that one.
And the improvement expansion, that's from Deb.
That's it?
Yeah.
Sure. So four right there. Yeah.
thing, because we need to know if that's going to be thrown into this or not.
The acting is assertive community treatment, and it's a function of OMH. And there are ACT teams in several counties in New York State. Our ACT team is based out of Watkins Glen. It's the Elmira Psych Center ACT team. And its function is to work with persons with serious and persistent mental illness who have not succeeded with traditional mental health treatments. So, you know, somebody who's asked to come in regularly for appointments or staying on their meds or staying out of the hospital. Sometimes you have to do what's called a SPO application, which is multiple pages, and submit it to the SPO committee. And then the SPO committee ascertains whether or not this person is appropriate for ACT. One of the problems with the current team that we have is it doesn't cover all of Tompkins County. The ACT teams have to work within a 45-mile radius of their hub. So there's parts, once you hit the Trip Hammer Bridge, pretty much SOL for the ACT team, because it's outside of that 45-mile radius
from Watkins.
That's ridiculous.
You're preaching to the choir here. They are talking about expanding the current ACT team that serves our community as well as other communities, but that's not a done deal yet. And somehow NAMI got associated with this as if it was NAMI's team.
Yeah, did you see that site that I sent you that
put
it under
well,
there?
Well, NAMI supports the ACT team.
Please remind me what NAMI is.
National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Alliance of the Mentally Ill. So a lot of family members with persons who have children or spouses or family members with mental illness. It's like a support informational clearinghouse and offers support groups and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I didn't connect
with NAMI is very supportive of ACT because they realize that not everybody can do the traditional mental health kind of, you know, hoop jumping that's required. And this goes to the person's residence. It works with the person. The team is comprised of, our current team is comprised of a psychiatrist, master's level person, two social workers, and two nurses. That's the current makeup of the team. They're supposed to help people get to the services they need. We struggle sometimes with that, again, because of the locations, but they're supposed to help people get to services. Like, they don't provide, per se, substance abuse treatment, so we try to get people hooked up with the counselor cars, but it doesn't always work out so well, again, because the person, the client, may be averse to coming into, you know, walking through doors to get to people's, but they're supposed to help them with that. They're supposed to help them with medication adherence so that the person can hopefully get to a more stabilized place in life where they can become more functional, maybe even get employment. They've had some wonderful, wonderful successes. It's just amazing to me how somebody's made the 180 completely. Somebody who was a hoarder, who didn't come out of his house. We were doing emergency outreach on, like, every 6 months because the neighbors were afraid of him. ACT got involved with him. This guy is now out of the house, cut his hair, has a job, is living in a reasonably clean environment, I mean, for him. And it's like the greatest thing since Wonder Bread. Well, some people like Wonder Bread, I guess. But so that's what an ACT team is. It's a sort of community treatment. It's been around probably about 7 or 8 years now. But you get assigned to the ACT team through the SPOE, S-P-O-E, single point of entry.
Yeah. Which is
in our place.
Your place.
It talks about SPOE, single point of access. it's all these alphabet soup things. Single point of access in our clinic is for children. Single point of entry is for adults. And they're different. They operate differently. But NAMI is supportive of it. But it's not NAMI has no authority or oversight over it whatsoever.
Right. They just lobbied for its initial passage.
We have probationers who have been involved in this program, and it's been a real asset. I mean, we're talking serious mental health issues.
You have to be seriously and persistently mentally ill to get ACT.
Hearing voices, schizophrenia. They've been very responsive to the probation officer. It's been a big assist to the probation officer because they're just like
there's some other resource who can, like, go out there and deal with crises and things like that.
One of the downsides is that it is voluntary. So if the client says, I don't want to have anything to do with you, they can't.
And that's happened.
Mm-hmm. Push their services. Like, we get clients walking back into the clinic. I fired ACT. I want to come back to Danny. Or I fired ACT. I want to come back. Yeah. You know, so that's always a possibility. And we have some people, some folks out there who have had ACT, who've had traditional mental health services, who don't want to touch anything anymore. So we end up seeing them on emergency outreach periodically when the things get a little bit out of control. I'm sorry if I
interrupted. No, I was just going to say the medication compliance piece is. Because they will do injection medication, which is long-lasting. It lasts for a couple of weeks in the system. So
different than the oral.
Well, you definitely know there's adherence if you're getting an injection rather than did you swallow your pill.
Right.
There's 100 ways of cheeking a pill these days. It's amazing. So.
And they will give them?
Yes, they have two nurses, as I said. There's always a nurse. It's a multidisciplinary team, so there's always a nurse. There's always a social worker. There's always a psychiatrist.
And they function out of the mental health clinic?
No, they function out. Actually, our team,
our local team,
out of Watkins.
Is their office is in Watkins, but their oversight is through Elmira Psych.
So where do they deliver the services for our area?
Up into the Trepanner Bridge and pretty much Trumansburg and Field.
What I'm saying is they will go to the client.
They go to the client's home.
But there's nothing in Tompkins.
In Dry,
there is no ACT team. There's no ACT team services passed.
I think we had somebody in Cougar Heights, but that's probably like more than four.
Yeah, we got somebody on. Oh, what's that really steep road with the church next to it? I don't know. There's
so
one.
These programs are scattered around the state. They're not 45 miles apart or 90 miles apart.
No, there's several of them. There's a few of them in the western region, a few of them in the central region, and a few of them in the eastern region.
Is that because it's associated with the psychiatric hospital?
Pretty much, And I did notice on the one that has the improvement, if ACT is done.
Yeah, number four.
But on the first page, it's under number two, mental health and substance AOT person. AOT is a legal action through the courts. It's on the improvement one, the one that Deb handed out. AOT is assertive outpatient treatment, which is basically like mental health probation, where you can be required to take medication over objection.
Assertive what?
Assertive outpatient treatment. It's Kendra's law, if you've heard.
We have to do those, yep.
If you've heard what those are, right? The petitions go through the county attorney's office. So it's a legal action, and there is no AOT person. Anybody who is asking about AOT, the request for an AOT investigation goes through our commissioner, and there's a series of questions that need to be asked before we even say, okay, let's go forward with the AOT stuff, which is, again, legal action.
Okay, I must have, I talked to someone with the VA who told me that many counties have someone who does that right in the jail.
We don't, that's not anything we've ever done in the jail.
I'm just saying, she says it's common in other counties.
Well, the criteria for being put on AOT is that you have to have had violence or threats of violence within the last 4 years, and you can... If you were in jail two of the last 4 years, you actually get to go 6 years back. So anytime in a hospital or in jail gets deducted from the time, I'm saying, like the 4 years. Or two hospitalizations due to noncompliance with medication in the last 3 years. And then again, the time spent incarcerated or hospitalized gets subtracted or added on to the AOT. A judge, it's usually Judge Mulvey, who the case
Here's
goes to the client has to come in voluntarily for the evaluation by the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist develops a treatment plan, which could include substance abuse, medication, housing, a bunch of different things. And then the case goes before the courts. And the client is entitled to representation free of charge by Mental Hygiene Legal Services. It's usually the Syracuse office. Kevin Mosher, that comes up.
Yep.
but there's also a Binghamton office that people, the Mental Hygiene Legal Services comes from. So the client is represented by Mental Hygiene Legal Services, or they can choose representation of their choice if they can afford to pay for their own attorney. It's not an assigned counsel case at all. It's either Mental Hygiene Legal Services or paid attorney. Goes, and then the county represents mental health in terms of the how this goes forward. And a person can then be ordered to AOT. And again, that's now, they have to be compliant with their appointments, with their medications. AOT can order ACT, you know, as a service versus a coming into the clinic kind of service. But it's kind of like mental health probation.
Yeah.
What does it stand for again?
Assertive outpatient treatment. It's part of Kendra's law. Well, it is Kendra's law.
So maybe what we wanted to do was mental health and substance abuse treatment in the jail. Mm-hmm. Because these people are in the jail, so that's what we're dealing with, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the intent of the statement was,
right?
Yeah, well, the idea was to, yeah, that there's currently just the emergency mental health treatment in the jail.
Yeah, crisis.
Crisis, yeah, the suicide or, you know, homicide. There's no ongoing...
There's no therapy. There's supportive counseling. Like if somebody's going through a rough time, we'll see people more than once or twice.
Right.
You know, if they have death of a, you know, of someone, or they're related, they get a Dear John letter, we might see them, you know, for that. But there's not therapy per se. It's
right.
Supportive counseling and crisis that we do in the jail.
So
one of the problems with doing therapy in the jail is if you really get to a very sensitive issue, there is no place, safe place for that person to go to now deal with the consequences of what may come out as a result of that safe issue or unsafe issue.
And I think the other thing, the other thought was when I was talking to the person from VA is that this AOT person, maybe it's not that, maybe I've got it wrong or she called it wrong, is that they make sure that the person receives therapy upon discharge. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that.
Well, actually, Penny, if people need to be in therapy after the jail, Penny makes those appointments.
I have a very hard time getting many of my clients into mental health services.
Well, we have open access now. Are you aware of that? Open access is between 9 and 3. It means people can walk onto the third or the fourth floor and say, I want to see a mental health treatment provider.
Fourth floor?
Fourth floor. And you just walk in. There's no more scheduling intake appointments because we found that our no-show rate was pretty high for that. So there's a company that does a lot of research with organizations, and our agency has decided to go with some of their practices, and one of them is open access, which means there are no more scheduled intake appointments, except forensics has scheduled intake appointments because people with court orders need to have the court order and know what's being asked of that person so that we can assign them to the correct person. But somebody that just wants to come in for mental health services between 9 and 3 walks in and says, I need to see a therapist. They might triage and say, how serious is this issue?
Because I didn't know this.
Somebody might be suicidal and somebody might be dealing with something less serious to them, because what's serious to me may not be level of seriousness change or different for different people. So open access is relatively new.
Is that every day?
Monday through Friday.
Cool.
Really cool. And they're seen that day?
More often than not, they're seen that day. If 15 people walk in, they may not everybody may get seen that day. They're triaged and they say, can you come back tomorrow? But more often than not, everybody is seen. I'm not sure they've had a day where people had to be sent, away and come back the next day.
And do they get evaluated at that point for a diagnosis?
They get an intake, yes.
Okay, so there is an evaluation as part of that.
Yes. They may not see the doctor, though. Some people walk in expecting to be able to see a psychiatrist that day for medications. That doesn't typically happen.
Mm-hmm.
So... we need to change that.
I have a question. It should be pertinent to kind of where we're going. But Linda, can you say, give an estimate of how many people are in the jail with serious mental health issues that got, that's what got them in there?
It's not as many as most people believe. I mean, a serious and persistent mental illness is schizophrenia, bipolar disorder with psychotic features, major depression, that is incapacitating, maybe with or without psychotic features.
some anxiety disorders can be incapacitating. So how serious and persistent mental illness is defined, people may have issues, but they may not rise to the level of serious and persistent mental illness. So we expect people to feel depressed when they're in jail.
Yeah.
We expect people to have trouble sleeping.
That's a normal response.
People who are committing criminal acts or maybe hearing voices or they're...
It's relatively small, actually. Because if it was larger, we would have more CPL 330 cases, and we don't.
That's using the serious and persistent definition of mental illness. I mean, so you're cutting off a lot of the people who are suffering from a mental illness but aren't suffering from schizophrenia, bipolar.
Give me an example.
Or aren't complaining about their mental illness.
Give me an example.
Well, we have a number of clients that, I mean, have serious recurrent depression, anxiety, and other issues. I mean, I'm not saying those mental illnesses are to blame for all the criminal behavior by any means. I mean, they're just another contributor along with substance abuse or something else. But they're not receiving services those.
What we find with the people many people who complain of mental illness while they're in the jail do not receive services before they came to jail nor after they leave the jail by their choices. So you have to wonder what's really going on for that individual.
I think that's true for some. I also know that we've been unable, now with open access, it could change dramatically, but we've been unable to access mental health services through SBOE, through SPO, for a number of clients.
Well, SPO is an entirely different McGilla. SPO is very specific about Lakeview Mental Health Housing and ACT Team. It's not just accessing mental health services. To access mental health services until we got open access, all you had to do was call the 6200 number and schedule an intake appointment. That's all you had to do. SPO is an entirely different McGill. SPO's about Lakeview Housing and ACT.
And ACT.
Girls. Yeah.
But coming back to Pat's question, seems to be. I certainly remember from the days when I was interacting with people in the jail that there'd be people who no doubt would have been diagnosed with a serious and persistent mental illness if they had actually spoken to a mental health professional, but they weren't complaining about their illness, they were just experiencing it.
But persons with serious and persistent mental illness usually give clues, and the jail staff is really educated, in my opinion, about recognizing those kinds of things, maybe not in your day, but as time has progressed. I firmly believe that the jail has become very competent in working with persons with mental illness and saying, hey, this guy needs to get seen or this woman needs to get seen, something's not right.
Or they need to get bailed. We get that a lot.
Would you bail this person out because they don't have the capacity to deal with it.
Right,
and there is no mental health housing unit in our facility. So, when we put somebody on constant watch, the jail goes, ugh. But we mental health don't put them on. We make the recommendation they be put on constant watch. It's up to the jail to decide whether or not to take that recommendation or not. More times than not, they take it.
What do you think?
No, I'm just, I know that at probation, our mental health caseload has risen because I assign those cases to a specific PO who has a master's degree and she's skilled in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to give her those cases because I think, her success with those cases would be better than the average person. But our numbers have gone up. So
your numbers of
months, people with some serious mental
Well, there's problems. there's historically been an inverse relationship between the number of persons in jail versus the number of available psychiatric beds. When you decrease the number of available psychiatric beds, the number of persons with mental illness rises within the jail population. That's historically been a constant.
And we know that those facilities are closing and that it's really hard to get into those facilities. So yes, we are seeing them in the community and we are seeing them in the jails and we're seeing them on probation. So I don't know, I'm just trying to think of this continuum of things we're thinking about here is that an issue or a population we want to target for
what is the question?
Well, yeah. If they're taking up jail beds, is there something that we could come up with that would?
But I guess it goes back to the question: are they taking jail beds because of their mental illness, or are they taking up their jail beds because of something else?
because we have a lot of folks with co-occurring disorders, and it's hard to parse out what's the substance abuse, because substance abuse can mask mental illness, or it can make it appear that mental illness exists when it doesn't. So, you know, you've got to parse that out too, which is sometimes difficult to have the person get clean, because you're going to feel anxious, you're going to be a little depressed, you're going to have a lot of, you know, emotional reactions to those kinds of things.
I mean, one thing that strikes me is, like, we have co-occurring disorders. What about co-occurring treatment in the jail? You don't have to parse it out so much. That mental health and substance abuse are both there treating people in the jail. I mean, without that netting of those two together, what we see consistently is just a vicious cycle with the people. You know, it's going round and round and round, and it's a dozen people in this community.
The same dozen,
and then you throw in a few that are seriously, you know, it's rare that they'll be arrested, but it's the same dozen that are cycling around because the treatment isn't integrated.
So are we talking about either stopping before they get into the jail, treating when they get out of the jail, or are you thinking about treatment in the jail when the median number of days is only 8?
Well, it's not 8 for the ones I'm talking about.
That's what I'm wondering.
Those people are doing, you know,
months and months.
Sentence days or unsentenced days?
Both.
I think you left out an option. I think the question is, are there people who are in the jail with serious mental health issues where they and we would be better off if they were out of the jail and getting appropriate treatment?
It would depend on what they're
My impression is there may not be a consistent methodology for identifying.
Well, they do the ADM 330 screening on everybody who comes through the jail, which is a series of questions. That one of the questions is, you know, have you been treated for mental illness? Or, you know, have you been in a psychiatric hospital? Have you attempted suicide before? Are you thinking about suicide now? And then there's the observational section where this person appears anxious, depressed. This person is crying. There's the factual kinds of questions. So I think there's 17 or 18. And then there's the observational questions that are, again, you know, what is the booking officer observing with this detainee as he or she is doing the booking in? And we use that as part of our assessment, who needs to get seen today when we walk into the jail.
So then Penny would see them, and then if she sees someone with a serious mental health problem, would she make a referral to SPO?
SPO doesn't play a role in that.
In the jail.
Why wouldn't it? I mean, if you got somebody with a serious mental health problem,
then you want to get them into treatment. You don't want to get them to SPO necessarily. SPO comes.
Isn't SPO the act? What you have to go through to get
ACT?
Right, but ACT is a serious deal. But you got to get treatment first. You've got to fail out of traditional treatment first. ACT is for those persons who have not benefited from.
Okay, so then the question is, when someone gets a mental health intake at the jail, what kind of referral can happen in that situation?
They can be referred to substance abuse. They can be referred back to the clinic. They may already be open, so their therapist of record gets contacted. They may have a therapist in the community. That therapist gets contacted. If they're on meds, we make sure that the person who's prescribing the meds gets contacted so the meds are continued in the jail, even if we're not the prescribers.
But that's all for providing treatment while they're in the jail.
Right, so depending on what they want.
I didn't hear a mechanism there. For recommending that they not be in the jail so that they can get more effective treatment.
No, there wouldn't be that unless the recommendation was to forensically hospitalize.
Are you familiar with the TASC program in Albany County, the flyer that I brought today?
I'm not.
Tell us about it, too, because I haven't read that.
All right. It's really short. And I'll just read it to you. Albany County. TASC stands for Treatment Alternatives for Safer Communities. It began in 1984. It currently serves persons charged with new arrests, probation, or parole violators, and persons returning to the community from state prison. Services include evaluation, placement in drug, alcohol, mental health treatment, court advocacy, case management, and monitoring for progress reports to the courts. Task operates separate transitional residences for men and women and provides on-site parenting classes, cognitive behavioral therapy groups, and an employment readiness program. And essentially, and I've got a friend who works as the overnight supervisor for the women's facility. And it's a transitional kind of place for people that are, as it said, coming out of prisons, that are on, have been violated parole as opposed to being in the jail, coming out of jail and don't have any place to go, where they have this sort of broad spectrum evaluation of people, but most importantly, they provide a secure bed for them with a curfew, with a staff, checks to make sure they're clean and sober, and then they can go out during the day for their treatment, their jobs, or anything else they've got going on. It's kind of like an all-in-one catch-all for this population. And I only found out about it because I had a good friend at Albion who seriously needs long-term residential treatment, and she was trying to parole to a 9-month residential program in Albany as a condition of parole. But since the treatment center can't guarantee, yes, you can have a bed the day you get out, she could go to the task facility and stay there until a bed opened up and be in a safe place, have some evaluation, get started on stuff. And when I read this, I thought, well, God, isn't this what we're trying to do here in this county, only we're doing it in little pieces and parts? This is, seems to be under one umbrella and includes the residential portion.
It integrates a lot of the services
exactly.
We've been talking about.
But it's talking about not incarcerated. At the moment.
That's coming out, right?
Yeah.
Coming out.
Yeah. It's all about the people that, or
new arrests.
For new arrests, in other words, it can be an alternative to going into, the, I mean, maybe they go in and spend a few days, get processed or whatever, but then they're sent out to the task place to continue with their evaluation and have a safe bed.
Yeah.
So I attended a presentation by one of the task coordinators several months ago. They actually came to our probation director area 2 meeting and we invited them to come. So it's pretty small. They only can deal with like, I'm going to say 15 people.
Men or women?
The women's residence I think was like 6 and the men's was like 12. Maybe, you know, something like that. And it is for people who are at risk of incarceration at the probation violation stage even, so that's why I wanted to hear more about it. I kind of felt like we already do a lot of the things that they do there. I mean, really the only thing that this does is it takes the person out of the community here and puts them up there and then kind of gives them the services we already give. Like my day reporting program does a lot of what that does. The council and cars does a lot already of what this program does. They have to go to treatment outside of the residence for like the morning. So that would be, you know, your intensive. Your outpatient. Then they go back to the residence and they get GED instruction and employment training, which is kind of similar to what
they
reporting
do
does.
Reporting.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of felt like for us it wasn't.
I agree that I think that this county, when I read all this, I thought, well, we do this and we do this,
we do.
But the one thing that we don't do is provide a place for people to be sleeping.
Yeah,
it goes back to the
it
issue
kind
of
takes them out of their environment here.
Yeah.
But they have to come back eventually. You know, they have to come back.
Because the part that caught my attention is the residential part. Mm-hmm. For the people who do not have a safe place to go or a safe family or any place to go coming out, and it doesn't have to be forever. I mean, these people come in and out like maybe within a couple of weeks or a month or whatever as they move into longer-term treatment or find housing. But that's one of the, I think, the thing that we really lack in Tompkins County. We have all these programs, but we don't have a place for people.
It's very
a safe place for people to sleep.
Very expensive. DSS has to.
I was just going
to
ask.
DSS has to
funding.
Agree to pay for it, and it's comparable to like Concord Care Level 2.
I have to say, that's $930 a month. I think.
Well, mm-hmm.
How much?
I'm not making a lot of money on that end of the spectrum. Is it $83?
Maybe it's
a day?
More. I don't know. But I remember that the local DSS from the county would have to agree to pay for the person.
Because I think that's the real weak spot. in so much of what we do do is the housing situation for people coming out of the jail, just going back to where they were shacking up before. And then there's the bus thing, which we're always talking about, the transportation.
Yes.
I experienced that just trying to get out to Briar Patch to work every day.
Right. I'm going to make a suggestion, is that we, because this one is something that we've talked about all along, is some of the mental health component and some of the substance abuse component, is go through the lists and cross off stuff that might have been a suggestion at the public input night or something like that. It's like, okay, we already do it, or, you know, and figure out what we want to look into, maybe what's something that's easy to do, you know, right now, something that is worthy of exploring, even if it's going to take, you know, a couple of years, and go through the whole list. I just don't want each meeting to deal with a few things on the list and that we don't get a plan in place to go through and really look at what we, you know, agree on as segments of things we do want to look at.
One last thing about PAC is there's a cap on the number of persons in Tompkins County to be acting. Can I hear?
Because
it's not unlimited resources. It's just the way it is. There's a cap.
Who establishes the cap?
OMH?
And what, if you know what the cap is?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, just.
So there's no, like, if it goes to the North Trip Hammer line, there's not another county act that picks up from there. So there's big gaps geographically.
Geographically, in Tompkins County, there's gaps for the service of the ACT team. Like I said, they're looking at expanding it, but that's not a done deal.
Okay.
They're looking to expand it to all of Tompkins County, but they still have a cap on the number of cases that they can supervise.
Okay. I wish we'd had a chance to get together and compile our stuff. Because there's... Oh, Eric, shoot.
Two things. One is, I only skimmed through this as it was passed out today, but I sort of quickly jotted down half a dozen things I could think of that I didn't quickly notice on the list. I'm not going to recite them right now, but I'll probably...
No, please, but we're going to try to compile these lists so that we have everything that we're going to sit down and go through.
Okay,
so
let me set that aside
listing,
for a moment. Because the second thing I want to mention is that a lot of these, and I think a lot of the things that were suggested at the public hearing, many of them might be good things to do for the community, or at least well-intended things to do for the community, but it's really not obvious that they're going to have any direct impact on jail population.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
And
that's,
I think we need to be pretty ruthless on weeding out things
right.
that... One can imagine how, in the long run, it might prevent some person from going to jail, but it's not really going to impact jail population.
That's
exactly
what I wanted.
Yeah.
That's exactly why I wanted to go through these, so that we can start chopping and figuring out what's got validity and substance to it, and what is not under our purview, makes no sense, or isn't, you know.
And we need more stuff added to it, stuff that, like, you're
okay,
seeing
so
that.
Right.
Quickly, I'm not trying to start a discussion with each of these now. We talked about empowering the Sheriff's Department to make bail ready to arrest. Is that on the list somewhere?
Yeah. Didn't I put that in here?
I didn't see it. But again, I was reading off
it
quickly.
On the list.
Number two, I gather that the new DBA program is started without us having to recommend anything.
Right.
But I think continuing to monitor that, see if it's being successful, and seeing if potential expansion might be a good thing.
What was that? The DBA.
Now, Joe, quick question on that. Isn't there some evaluative component in with that grant money at the end to look at it, right? At the end of the 3 years, I thought, is what Julia said. I thought Julia said there was going to be an evaluation period at the end of those 3 years, but we should confirm
that. Point
is
just that continuing to keep an eye on that, that expansion of that might be an attractive option at the appropriate time.
Based advocacy, right?
The new initiative of having counsel at late night arraignments. Judge Rowley talking about how a lot of the magistrates are not very happy about that just because it means that arraignments take a whole lot more time. And from his quick description, I thought there might be ways to tweak that so that it doesn't become quite so time-consuming. So just, I think thinking about how to streamline that process might
be. Just add, it's not just after hour arraignments. It's even if you have a defendant in court on your court day, and that defendant does not have an attorney that comes into play at that time also. So
okay,
it's actually 24/7.
It's initial arraignment.
If they are financially eligible to have assigned counsel to them, because they can say, no, I don't want, or I have my own attorney.
Yeah, but it's still going to be true for a lot of people.
Right, right.
So they don't have to have representation of this if they refuse
it. Excuse me?
They don't have to have representation. They just have to have the ability to have representation.
Well, they can't force you to have it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So if you can't afford an attorney, they're going to get one for you.
Correct.
But if you can't afford it and you don't care to get one, then it doesn't mean that you have to have an attorney present. You have to have the option.
That's correct. Right? They have to be eligible for assigned counsel.
Well, like I said, I'm trying to list these and not...
That's okay, because some of this stuff is perfect timing for what we're trying to do.
We talked about whether it's possible to encourage the sheriff to have an in-house policy that discourages judge shopping by road deputies.
Now, see, I thought that they said that didn't happen, that the dispatch actually does a geographical circling out of calling. They start with the justice who is closest
to the jurisdiction,
and then they move out geographically, that there's no judge shopping anymore was what I understood.
I've heard conflicting reports. Again, we heard it asserted that this doesn't happen, and I think we shouldn't drop the idea just because someone says it doesn't happen.
I can say in my 3 years so far, I have never been called by a police officer directly. I've always been called by dispatch for arraignment. I've never been called by a deputy or a trooper. Or even police.
I don't know enough about the innards of the process.
I'm just saying. Yeah. So.
And you're not the only magistrates that said that.
When you say dispatch, do you mean
911
the person
center.
At the 911 center?
Center. Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah,
the deputy or trooper or park police will have a person under arrest. They typically call
they
dispatch
call
and say, would you contact a judge for arraignment for a town of Ulysses, Enfield?
Do they ask for which judge?
Not that I know of.
Because there's some judges who have other reputations.
Well, there's their judge.
And you know what? If there's a judge that doesn't pick up the phone, whether he chooses not to or he's not there, we don't control that.
I want a judge.
I've never had that happen. I quite often, there's some disparity because the judges in the townships are never available. That's one of the issues which creates that calling other judges because certain judges just won't answer the phone or partake.
Unless you get Dr. Day's pay then.
Isn't part of what they're working on, you might know, Joe, kind of a, or you would certainly know, Mark, kind of like a on-call list? They're exploring that so that...
They may change the arraignment procedure to have an attorney on call for 24 hours each day, and you would rotate through alphabetical order on that list. The only issue I see with that is that I'm very fortunate. I have four attorneys who live in the village of Trumansburg. I've been very fortunate so far having a very quick contact with the attorneys. If my concern with the rotational list, I may have an attorney who lives in Waverly or Moravia that you have to call to drive all the way to the town of Ulysses in a snowstorm.
Because what they had talked about initially was geographic, a geographic kind of list of breaking.
That's what I have right now.
Right, and they're talking about moving away from that?
Yes,
and
going to an on-call list. All the attorneys you have that do assigned counsel work would be by alphabetical order. And that one attorney
that's
would
put a lot more
say,
time.
You know, say Jim Baker, he would be on call today from noon until noon tomorrow and stuff like that.
But the ones that
when,
know
when
they're
Jim Rowley
on
presented
call.
On this, I understood him to say that what happens is that the defendant gets taken to the judge. And then if the judge thinks it's appropriate, the judge calls for the assigned counsel person to come in, and then they have to wait. And I'm wondering if there would be situations in which the attorney can be contacted before the detainee makes it to court,
The situation, Eric, is that the way it's set up, when they come into court, I have to give them the application for assigned counsel. Mm-hmm. They have to fill out the application for assigned counsel, which is 3 pages of financial history. Upon completion, they sign it. Then I have to review that to see if they meet the threshold for assigned counsel. So there's where your time starts to accumulate. And then I have to stop and get on the phone and make contact with the attorney at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. The issues that I see, I had one defendant that was totally incoherent. right. in court and throwing up in a garbage can. So there I sat trying to assess, and finally I hit the point where I just called an attorney to come in and represent him.
I'm not trying to figure this out on mm-hmm. the fly right now.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that looking for are there ways to streamline mm-hmm. that process is worth looking at.
And one thing,
and it might turn out that there aren't any ways, but I think it would be worth it.
And one thing that I proposed, because Judge Lippman was the one who created this whole issue as far as representation at the initial arraignment, and again, it goes back to dollars for assigned counsel, but when the defendant comes into court, just assign an attorney at that point to represent them. Without going through all the financial affidavit, just you call an attorney, the attorney comes in for initial arraignment, the person is arraigned, and then the defendant's given the application for assigned counsel, that can be filed with assigned counsel the very next day. That may save a lot of time as far as the time that you actually sit in court.
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing.
And what we already do is that'll kind of dovetail, and this is not anything that we control, mind you. This is OCA and mm-hmm. the court system working with the magistrates, and they're going to work it out, and they're going to streamline it as they go. It's a work in progress, and it's very brand new. But when we have a defendant who is subsequently found, whether it's at that initial arraignment or later on in the process, found to be not eligible, they've got much, you know, more money than they thought or were found to have, we have to go back and try to get the money. The judge will sign an order saying you are ordered to reimburse the assigned counsel program, blah, 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 money. If they don't pay it, I gotta go after them. So there are mechanisms already in place for us to try to do that, and I think that OCA, I think the key step has already been taken, getting people at the initial arraignments, which we believe and hope will help keep people out of jail. How you can streamline it and make it better is not under our purview, but it's a good thing that that started, because that was a suggestion that came up.
Presumptive eligibility makes some sense, though, as far as just speeding it along, and then, because we do all the intakes the next day at the jail and stuff, the three-page thing that you're talking about, OAR does them 4 days a week. Frankly, most people that we, by the time we get them, if they're in jail, they're eligible. You know, there's going to be some that you're going to, you know, give assigned counsel to that will bail themselves immediately and obviously weren't eligible. But almost everyone we interview is eligible for assigned counsel.
Yeah. So
anyway, to finish my list, and again, I'm not trying to not have a discussion of each of these on the fly. I'd certainly like to learn more about what might be done in terms of in-house policy in the DA's office, in terms of how they deal with recommendations for incarceration, either pretrial or in sentence.
I'm going to make a recommendation there. Finish the rest of your list, and then we're going to come back to that.
I'd like to see more consistent ongoing contact between something like the ATICJ board and the magistrates.
That's it.
That's kind of an ongoing encouragement to participate in whatever form that might take. And also, I think there's still periodically issues of, particularly at late night arraignments, defendants who are unable to get themselves home and may be jailed in the absence of transportation. And that's a tough one to solve, but I'd certainly be interested in hearing a discussion of how we might address it.
Got to figure out how often does that happen?
The guy puking in the basket was one instance.
Yeah, his attorney take him home?
No.
I mean, I originally got that as an issue from Jack Sherman when he was city court judge.
I mean, IPG took a right hold of that, the, and they put him in the holding cell, and they let him, but we
and that turns into a huge liability factor as far as the police.
I absolutely understand it's hard to solve.
It goes way back when I worked the road, and that's what was one of the large issues that we had. You have somebody that, you know, they have nobody, they don't want to call anybody, and they're on their own, and they're uncooperative. And
drunk, high,
intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. Public safety, they go home, they get a ride home from somebody, and they get back in the car.
I mean, even a taxi cab or... I mean, it's still a liability issue if you release that person and they end up getting killed or run over or jump out of the taxi.
That's one of those people that needs to go to jail.
Or the sobering up station if we have one.
Or not. Yeah. What are we going to do with them?
I'm not proposing that I got a quick and easy solution right now, only that's one place where people are going to the jail where they might not.
I think it's like a wet shelter, I say. You could get them down to the wet shelter.
Probation for a special detox center.
Thanks.
Man, 24 hours a day.
It was the wet shelter that you had.
Well, I know what they do in California. Well, You just kind of sleep it off in the junk tank.
Anyway, that's the end of my list.
Okay. I'm going to propose we take off number 4. That's kind of out of the purview here.
Affordable housing?
Under Deb's list.
Which 4, though?
The very first number 4.
Housing.
Yep, housing.
Downtown.
Yeah.
All for all.
I mean, I would take that out and be more specific pursuant to the needs of the people in the jail. Mental health, substance abuse. Because I think that that would be addressed in the halfway house or transitional house or whatever. I just, I mean, general downtown.
Yeah, we don't have anything we can do
right,
about it.
Right.
It's one of the things that's mentioned at the public meeting repeatedly.
What about the bus passes?
Bus passes for whom?
That was the question that some people had was, how do you determine eligibility? Is it probation?
It's people? For clients. I mean, people who are being placed and housed in Groton and mandated to treatment downtown. You know, it's for things like, I mean, we regularly get the parole releasees coming into our office at 8 o'clock in the morning who need to get to Elmira. That day.
So you're talking about for your clientele, or are you talking about?
Well, the public mentioned it. I mean, and it's a regular request from clients of ours. It's the reason I'm putting it out there. It's just there's a huge disconnect between housing, employment, treatment, parole meetings. I mean, a lot of money spent on transportation.
All right, so let's put a question mark there, and then we could explore who. And where would they
get this still? Are we supposed to be talking about alternatives to incarceration? I mean, a lot of these issues are a problem for people coming out of jails, but does this reduce the jail population? That's what you were saying.
Good question. Good question.
It doesn't reduce the jail population. It's a pain in the ass.
It could help them get the treatment, which could reduce them recidivating.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying it's like, which people are we talking about? Only those people going to treatment?
But people going to treatment can get bus passes through the Syracuse MAS for their treatment appointments or mental health appointments or doctor's appointments.
What's the MAS?
Medicaid transportation no longer goes through DSS down here. It goes through a Syracuse-based company called MAS. And you call them and you can get them to give, if they come to a specific group same time every week, or their appointment is the same time every week at the council or CARS, you get them hooked up and they will give you 6 months worth of bus passes mailed to the individual.
For treatment.
So treatment only, not for like parole appointments or that kind of stuff, but for treatment if it's to a physician, substance abuse, or mental health.
So it helps people not go back to the jail.
Potentially.
Bill.
So, you know, I think you have to think about this thing like sort of public, you know, public health model. So primary prevention does one thing, secondary prevention does another, tertiary prevention does another. You just can't, because if you want to do them all, I mean, you can make a case that all of them help. I mean, really. And I think what you're saying, Linda, is that mental health services aren't exactly this panacea that's going to keep people out of jail. So, because the number of SBMI people in jail because they heard voices and threw a brick through a jewelry store window is extraordinarily small.
Exactly.
Extraordinarily small.
Exactly.
The number of people who have, like, dysthymia and, is that still a diagnosis?
Yeah,
I had that one.
Okay, so.
It's good, it's good for the 5.
Yeah, right. Like, dysthymia. Or, you know, long-term learning problems and impulse control disorders and all that kind of stuff. Well, when they get in the jail, would treatment in the jail benefit them? Well, I mean, no, wait, you can make a case that it would benefit them, but A, would it get them out of jail any quicker? Probably not. Would it prevent it from recidivism? Probably not. I don't know. But it's a stretch. So I think, I mean, when I look at Halfway House, like, I don't think Halfway House belongs. I mean, I don't think that's going to make any impact on keeping people out of jail. Maybe you could make a case for a wet shelter, okay? Transitional housing, the same thing. Is that helpful? It's helpful in the same way that getting some kind of supportive counseling into the jail and having a lot more substance abuse treatment in the jail could do the same thing. But it's sure as heck not really going to keep people out of jail. I don't think so.
But you got to include getting them out of jail earlier than they would.
Yeah,
otherwise.
Now,
that's
right.
Where
that
housing comes in.
Right. I was thinking of the keeping them out of as opposed to getting them out early. I think those are also two different conversations. I think there
it's
are
reducing
some...
the jail population.
Huh?
It's reducing the jail population.
Right, but I mean, there are strategies that will meet both. Yeah. Will prevent people from getting in and get them out sooner, but there's ones that will only work to stop them from getting in and ones that will only work to get them out early.
Right.
So I think that's where, you know, that's where you have to sort of take a real ruthless kind of chop this thing down.
Mm-hmm. So maybe when we're discussing things, we should have
A and B.
Immediate, you know, things that could immediately affect jail numbers and things in the long term which could affect.
Get them out sooner. Jail
population.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think we should be, you know, if you guys, I'm not a member, so. I'm sitting from the
Your input's area. Important.
So, is
that we should,
that as a committee, you should be honest with yourselves that, like, the further you get out, the less reliability you have in terms of impact.
Right.
Like, the closer you are,
yep.
then you got a better chance at reliability. Like, when you start getting out here into some stuff, then it's like, yeah, if we redistributed income well throughout the United States, we'd have an impact on it, too. You know, I mean, they're just...
Go for that.
Yeah, so.
Okay, I'm taking bus passes off. No, that's a good point, Bill. Let's look at the increased coordination in services then. Particularly, I mean, we talked about mental health substance abuse. What about the parole and probation coordination?
Is this coordination between parole and probation?
Yeah. I don't think there is any coordination between, but it was like people were talking at the public hearing. There was somebody who was talking about the parole technical violators, and you know there are, and we had said at one point that was being reduced. There were fewer, but the numbers don't show that. The numbers that we've been getting from the CJS show that there still are about the same number of technical violations each month as there was a year before.
And what's a technical violation?
Well, I mean, all I know is, like, for instance, an example I have is a client who called his parole officer to say, I will be out of my house at 6:50 because I have to catch the bus into my job. And he was not supposed to be out of the house before 7 a.m. And he was violated for being out of the house at 6:50. Those aren't rare. They happen on a periodic basis.
Typical technical violations, hot urines, finding alcohol in the house, with the sex offenders having kids around them when they're not supposed to.
It's violating the orders and conditions of probation.
Right. They haven't committed a new crime. It's just violating some condition.
Then there is being violated for a new arrest. So that's a separate.
Right, that's a separate issue. I was talking about the technical ones that we hear about where you're supposed to be when.
And those are so arbitrary.
Well, they're fairly arbitrary in our experience. But then the other issue is that they're not violated for having six or eight of them living in Groton in the same house where you're supposed to, you know, you're not supposed to consort with other felons or parolees. Mm-hmm. You know that in that house in Groton there's alcohol and substances, and yet they're not violated
We're all living together.
Yeah, they're living together. I mean, something's broken is all I'm saying about this, and it's not between parole and probation necessarily, but there are a lot of violations, and they're staying in jail a fair number of days, our parole violators.
Parole we have no control over.
Right, they're not probation.
What about violation?
Unless... It really all restitution with us, and then I assure you there is coordination between probation and parole and trying to get the restitution collected.
Right.
But I know with probation, we do graduated sanctions on technical violations. We go through the process. We don't violate the first time someone tests positive on their urine screen.
I think parole tends to play things pretty differently sometimes.
Well, they used to, but I think they're getting
better. They're not as quick to jump
because
on
they've gotten any more. State from
yeah.
Well, the numbers aren't showing that.
A lot depends on who the parole officer is. They are not uniform.
Well,
the way
a lot
they
depends on the parolee,
it.
Too.
Exactly. It depends on the parole officer's attitude towards the parolee.
Well, it also depends on the parolee and his or her behavior.
Right, exactly. It's very complex.
Accountability.
But they're taking out beds.
When Jeff's talking about it statistically, that kind of averages out.
Variable.
That averages out the parolee's responsibility.
Again?
That if what we're seeing is relative stability in how many people are getting violated, where we are wishing that it was declining, I don't think that's because of some kind of change in the average parolee.
You have to look at how many more people are going to prison if they are, in order to look at that number.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we have the
numbers. Or how many more are getting out, actually.
I don't think we have the numbers. I would recommend taking that off unless somebody has some specific ideas on what we could do with that.
We could loan it.
I can imagine
probation
at
has already graduated.
Time, someone wanting to just have to sit down with the local parole officer or officers and exploring, is there ways to better coordinate and invite them to share in Tompkins County's priority of trying to keep jail population low.
What are your thoughts on that, Pat?
They wouldn't violate if they had more adequate housing.
The two parole officers are pretty nice guys.
Yeah, they're pretty on top of things.
We have Dolan and we have Garahan right now. And I think those guys, from my experience with them, will bend over backwards and work with you if they think you're not bullshitting.
Yeah, that's fine.
If you're bullshitting them, then they're going to be on your case and they're going to be coming around.
Which is their job.
Which is their job. So
they believe in the mantra of I have no more power than you give me.
So I don't see a problem with the parole officer system, but that's a lot of it has to do with personalities, just based on the three that I know and all
who's
three
here
of
now.
Well, the only ones we can deal with are the ones that we have.
Yeah. So
no.
I would take the parole out of it because we don't have any control over it. And
right.
My opinion is that they do a really good job with the population that they have.
All right, we talked about the mental health and substance abuse. What about the meeting of the ATIs, the town judges, Mark and Pat? Give me some ideas on that.
Well, that was actually one of the things that I had written down as an immediate thing in my list that I put together, with educating the justices regarding the impact of the weekend sentences, because I don't think they understand.
That's a good thing to
me.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my pet peeve. I got to tell you.
The weekend thing. And I know the discussion you and Gwen started having at the CJATI meeting was, you know, Gwen also saying that the system, system saying, you know, there is also a punitive component to this. And that inconveniencing them by having them serve weekends is also part of the punishment of their sentence. What we can look at is there a different kind of punishment that would satisfy the courts? And I think that that's part of the discussion that I would love to see happen with the magistrates saying, what could we have given you that you would have liked to have seen in your dream of dreams that would have given you an alternative to putting them in jail? And what do you think they would say? Or is that a discussion that you need to?
I think it's a discussion, but you know, just keep in mind that at some point, as town justice, you get to a point where there's no place else to go, and you've done probation, you've done a conditional discharge, and they're back, and you struggle with it because you get to a point where there's no other avenue but incarceration.
Is
there some other avenue that you could wish for?
Is there a different avenue we could implement, or nothing else we would offer in our dreams is going to stop you from putting that?
Usually, an example like with a VOP, they've
VOP
gone violation of probation, or even a conditional discharge. You have set terms and conditions of their release, and they've totally failed to comply with that directive of the court. You've given them every chance that you can give them to comply, make themselves better, and maintain the conditional discharge or probation. Probation does a fantastic job. As far as you do a lot of work with a client before they ever come back to court on a VOP, a lot of work with those people. And just to me, sometimes it's frustrating because there's no other programs to put them into.
Including you're talking about having done swap and things like that.
You know, whatever's been there.
Programs.
I've tried other sanctions. You know, they've come back, you impose community service, you do other things, you send them back on probation, they come back, you get on a VOP. And I always say, the person has to want to help themselves in the system.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very frustrating to judge because you just seem to have no other solution but to incarcerate for that punitive sentence. And it's very frustrating, but sometimes you get to that point.
Right.
You have the input from the assistant DA, you have the input from your defense counsel, you have input from probation, you have input from all these different services, including CARS and everybody else, and it just gets to a point where, you know, it's difficult to really help that person without the final outcome is incarceration.
And one of the things that Judge Raleigh had said before was when we were talking about a sheriff's work program, whether it's, you know, they're there with a guard and they're picking up litter or whatever, the bottom line is they are still remanded to the custody of the sheriff in order to do that, right? So that's not going to cut down jail days at all, because if they don't have to go back to the jail at night, they're going to be in probation's work program. Is that right, Pat?
Well, yeah, we're the community base.
Right, but I'm saying that even when we had talked about, you know, the sheriff taking groups out and having them work in the community, that's not going to cut down jail days unless it is the carrot, right?
Well,
unless it's used
that,
as a carrot.
We used to have that reduced incarceration community service program.
What was that called?
Reduced incarceration community service.
That was RICS.
Yeah.
That was the RICS program. So we did away with that because we didn't have the numbers. But I know that some of the judges said, you know, for the dads that aren't paying support or the parents who aren't paying support, I would love to do that. Because you could take part of that money if they're cleaning up an area or a public area or a building or a state park or something, and, you know, it's saving the park a little money and they could kick in and that money could go into the pot that helps pay for the child support, something like that. Is that worth exploring again? Because the RICS thing was in a couple different places here. So is that something that, I mean, I think that's
is that
a daily use
where they still come back to jail at night?
Yep. But the carrot is that if you do this work, and it was pretty attractive to some of the inmates because they weren't just sitting there bored to death, they were getting out, and some of them were, you know, it was more productive.
Got anything to get out.
Right. And if you were doing this work under supervision, you did well, maybe earned some money along the way, that your sentence was reduced. I don't know by how much.
A lot. So here's an example. So for a misdemeanor.
I think I get it. So we're talking about sentenced people who can get their sentence reduced participating in the program.
It's right. Reduced up. They're sentenced to the program. So it's for an A misdemeanor, you can get up to a year in jail. So with the RICS program, the maximum sentence was 60 days. So you're cutting out a lot of jail time here if you're allowed to go into the RICS program. And in addition to that, you would have to do 104 hours of community service. So you do your 60 days, you'd stay in the jail, we'd have one of my staff would go up there, take them out of the jail, take them to a community service work site, eyeball them while they're doing their site, they're in their own custody kind of at that point, that was something the sheriff allowed. And then we would return them to the jail at night. Next day, Monday through Friday, we would go up and take them out. And then, at the end of the 60 days, they'd have their community service done, actually 45 with good time, and then they'd release. So that was a sentence that the court would impose.
Right.
Is that one-to-one staffing? Do you have to have one PO for every
No. Sometimes they took out multiple people, two to three, but you wouldn't want
usually
to
usually at most three to one.
You wouldn't want to get too big. If they run.
Right.
But I know was attractive for some because they were giving back. They were working. They were earning to go toward their child support, or they had to work, and they were made to work. And that was pretty attractive to some.
And why don't we have it anymore?
It stopped because the courts were underutilizing it. And when you looked at the number of jail days that were being saved compared to the salary fringes of the staff person, it wasn't paying for itself. So
that's why we stopped. So is that something that we could try to track for 6 months and see if we had this, would you have used it and get an idea of how many numbers would potentially... I'm looking for ideas.
Don't you first have to do the cost-benefit analysis?
It depends on how many. That's what the 6 months is for, is to see how many people would be in it.
First, we can ask, how many would we need in order to justify it?
Mm-hmm.
Sue's.
You know, I went to Diane Cohen's training program thing.
Oh, yeah.
So my thought was, instead of having almost a one-on-one thing, if your release was to a training program at a certain site, like the one that they're going to have down at the old BOCES building, where it's all set up, that they're going to train these people to be working, as opposed to going out and doing the community services they used to, almost one-on-one or one-on-two or three, you could send more people to an approved training site like that under supervision, because there'd be a lot of people around. Maybe that would be cost-effective.
So while they're still in the jail?
Yeah.
Serving
while
their sentence.
While they're still in the jail. You
getting
know, who wants
to yeah, tell us about that, because you were a godsend going to that open house the night that I couldn't. Tell us what you saw and
you
what you found and how
big
it is.
You reuse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, they bought the BOCES building down on the old Elmira Road, and they're going to refurbish it and have three different training programs or four different training programs, repairing electronics, repairing furniture, woodworking shop, and also for retail, people learning how to use computer-type cash registers, those are the wing type, and they would like to have people in a training program that are coming from probation or on parole. We want to help people with re-entry training. So that could be a site where people could do the day trip, the day programming, and then go back and spend the nights at jail. It might be more cost-effective.
With a reduced sentence.
Yeah.
And
because that's where you get your
they
savings.
They reached out to probation and talked to you guys already, mm-hmm. right, Billy Efgar?
She talked to one of my staff. I haven't personally spoken.
Do you know Diane?
And
yeah. I know her from years ago, too.
As a component
there's
day
a lot
reporting.
Of monitoring issues. I mean, I'm sure the jail would have to totally weigh in on this because, you know, you can't have, there's got to be really a lot of monitoring. You can't have inmates coming back to the jail with drugs,
right.
copping drugs, weapons, stealing stuff. I mean, it's...
So separating the males and the females.
Separate, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of issues to consider. But I'm not saying it's not in the realm of
smoking. And she's planning.
Smoking.
Yeah.
Contraband.
Diane's planning on those people being already released. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't, again, it wouldn't necessarily cut the jail population unless there was a way to translate that into sort of like a day reporting training.
I don't
program.
Think good. I'm sorry, I missed the part about what are you saying about Diane's attitude?
No, not her attitude. The way it's set up, it is a reentry program for people who have been released. It's not targeted for early release. It's not necessarily an ATI at this point. She's
you know. The monitoring that Pat was talking about
yeah.
kicks in for someone who's still in custody.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand there'd be more monitoring. I don't think Diane, I can't speak for her, but I don't think she would care whether they were out of the jail for the day or if they were released. I think she just wants to help people not
so what
get
if
back to get to retrain
sure.
them to continue on and have a different yeah. life. I don't think she cares whether they've been in the jail or not. And I don't know about the supervision. I mean, one sheriff's deputy down there for the day and the unit, if that could be handled or not. I mean, that's what you're doing before,
male and
right?
female down one. There, then you have to have a male and a female corrections officer.
Yeah.
Or if it would just be a component of, like, reentry.
So maybe you could just sentence them to that rather than sentence them to jail at all. So then you have no custody issues, so you've cut the cost. I mean, just, you know, have that as an option of, like, that's what you're going to do for the next 60 days is go to training.
One more
that's like a release
condition of probation.
Yeah.
Like a release under supervision, and that would be where they might go instead of day reporting.
What John was talking about.
That's kind of where my mind is going. Could you make this kind of another section of day reporting? Just like people...
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a day reporting. Well, that's that would be my dream, you know, when we get our new space. to be able to
actually that site is on the
incorporate the day reporting program as part of the reentry.
Just having watched the day reporting when I was reporting to probation all the time, the kids were bored most of the time out of their mind. But if they were going someplace and learning and doing stuff, I think it would be a whole other ballgame.
But again, that's because we've got custodial issues. But
yeah, but would a judge be more inclined to send somebody over to the program as a facility of day reporting? So instead of doing the day reporting GED or whatever happens there right now, could you have kind of another
satellite
element of that, which would be out in the community doing community
learning how to repair computers.
For training, yeah.
Because that, there are components of that, the hands-on stuff that doesn't happen at day reporting, because it can't. I mean, you don't have the big vocational space to learn.
Trained for what work.
We don't have
right.
contracts anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Learning how to do a skill.
I think that's a definite look at.
Yeah, I think it was really, I think it's really great that she's interested in this. Now, time frame with that, they're going to deconstruct the building, so it's nothing that's going to happen probably in 2014, unless I'm missing my guess. I have to spend more time talking to her, but it's probably going to be a while before they're up and ready to do it.
The other thing that I had on my list for educating the judges was reminding the courts that they don't have to order a pre-sentence investigation for a sentence of 6 months or less incarceration. So that's a time saver. I mean, you can go right to, if everyone's in agreement, the court can go right to sentencing. We don't have to wait for the PSI.
Was that part
weeks.
Of the change in the law?
Yeah, it was a change in the law.
I thought it was just for a population of 1 million.
No, it's,
okay.
The only issue that I see with that, a lot of times there's no agreement as to what the sentence is going to be.
Everybody has to agree.
And the ADA won't commit. Defense counsel argues for ROR, of course. And then, so you as a judge is sitting there, you have no idea where any recommendation is coming from, and that's quite often why the PSI is ordered. And I try to push, you know, through my clerk to contact the DA's office and try to get a handle on what they're looking at so I have some idea prior to making a decision to order a PSI.
Mm-hmm. So that's I know another it's, need for
part of the
very,
training.
It's very time-consuming on
training.
Your behalf.
Oh, getting back to that. You know, we can invite, but they're elected officials to do with their time as they wish. I would recommend that you give her a call, set up an appointment to speak
with
the DA.
To talk to her one-on-one rather than have her come to the meeting?
I have no power to make anybody come anywhere, Eric.
Do you think if you invite her, she'll turn you down?
Do you know how many times I have?
No.
I don't know what to say.
But she has turned you down?
I have issued the invitation numerous times for various meetings. I don't know what, you know, other stuff she has going on. I would imagine considerable. Some of them are at night. I don't know how convenient that is.
Is she on CJATI? Did you say yes. She was at a meeting?
Yes.
But she's a member of that committee.
Yep. And you said CJATI was not convenient to you.
Not typically.
You've
invited her to do a presentation? And
no,
she's
no. I've invited her to come so that we can get input on how the DA, mm-hmm. you know, comes to the decisions, as, you know, has been requested here.
I can do that if you want. I was thinking it was
more appropriate
to go through the committee, but I can do it.
You can get questions answered. Maybe it's email. You know, maybe we'll get some answers that way. I mean, I can't force people to come, and I'm not going to second guess what their other commitments are. You know, the invitations are extended.
I'll see what I can find out.
All right.
Feel on
free.
The mentoring?
Pam might have more on her list, too.
Just to remind the course that they can always ask for an updated pretrial release report. So if we do a report and...
Is this under the training for the magistrates and judges?
Yeah.
Which I imagine once we sit down and discuss it, there's probably going to be a lot of little tidbits that are going to go into there.
Where are you on the sheet? Are we on the sheet still?
No, we went... Mm-hmm. To Pat had some other things that fit into some
of
this.
Thought I was out of touch.
Well, I am.
No, we're not going. We're
Debbie Payne just recently asked me to do a presentation for the magistrates on mental health. That was whatever
OCA training you might
have
had.
Theirs or other people's?
I can't speak to that. There's HIPAA laws. But it was to follow on the OCA training that they had some recently, I guess.
Which would maybe be a good time when they're all together to discuss a few other things.
Yeah.
Just trying to get them all together is very difficult.
That's the difficult
part. When is
part.
That?
Like herding cats, right?
It hasn't been scheduled. They had a segment in Corey training on mental health in the courtroom. That was a very interesting segment they had as far as the training issue. And I felt it would be important for the judges to sit through a training
like
regarding
how
to recognize mental health and know what you're dealing with when a person comes into your courtroom. So Debbie Payne's going to set that up as far as
right,
the training.
There's no date that says
yeah, we're looking at, I think,
June.
Yeah, June.
But that's like
yeah.
Next week.
I told her probably July, you know, late July with the holidays and stuff, so.
But this might be a good meeting when they're all together for Pat, for you to, you know, to prepare some of these really nitty-gritty ideas that you've had, you know, about PSIs and pretrial release.
Well, I'm actually trying to set up a separate training with the clerks, separate training as well, so that might be, I mean, that's probably going to take all the time just talking about that topic.
And keep in mind, it's not to criticize, but it's very difficult to get a room full of all the town judges, mm-hmm. like anybody at times, with their schedules and stuff, conflicts. And it's typically you only have about half of the magistrates for the county and given training, so it's difficult.
Work in progress. All right. These were just some suggestions under the mentoring stuff. I know the circle of recovery that Gino had talked about, I think that's, you know, something the judges will have to decide if they...
It's a drug court thing.
Yeah, I mean, they do their drug court thing.
I don't know, they get sent, I mean, they have to
right.
turn in the, they, we have to turn in the, you know, their meeting lists and stuff. John Rowley does that in his treatment court. I think Gino is just...
letting us know that he was going to get
still
that up and
doing
running.
That or getting mm-hmm. back into that now that he's feeling better.
Veterans track, the county court, veterans mentoring program.
And Phoebe is going to do it for the women.
On the circle
does
on the circle of recovery,
recovery,
right.
And Phoebe is going to be doing the women's circle.
Yeah.
It's just more like, you know, FYI.
Right.
You've got people that want to refer them to. I defer to them.
And I thought it was good Judge Raleigh was there that night and heard, you know, a lot of the suggestions and stuff.
The veterans track is on here largely because Jim Murphy brought it up at the public hearing. I've met with Jim some, too, and met with the VA through Jim. And we've added, like, veterans questions to our intake at OAR because mm-hmm. we realize that there are other services that we can access for those.
Oh, good.
Folks. And there's an LCSW who comes down and does the mental health substance abuse evaluations if there's a vet. So we just didn't know that there was that resource. But one of the things is then it highlights for the justices or the judges if it's in our intake or if it's part of, you know, a form, that you're dealing with a vet here. And
is it? Yeah, is that on Bernadette's?
I'm sure if that's one of the
we
questions.
We should check.
I know pretrial release. I know we ask it in the PSI for sure.
We should know. Or could add it.
Do the vets, Veterans Administration provide mental health services or something?
Yeah, there's...
Well, like the judge said, he likes some better than others.
Right.
Well, it's just not uncommon.
They've been making headlines lately.
It's not uncommon to have somebody have their mental health treatment once a month. Have Bath or Syracuse.
Right.
There's some programs that are better than others.
Right. Schizophrenia.
Right.
Which, you
know, in the wind, right?
Yeah.
What about that mentoring student?
That was that Susan.
Cossack.
Susan
Cossack?
Yeah. That was a program she
high school
just,
guidance counselor.
I'm kind of inclined to think that the entire mentoring chunk here. Mentoring is a good thing, and I'm all in favor of
but
it.
But it's not going to affect our numbers.
But I don't see that
numbers.
It really is very closely connected to reducing jail population.
Yeah, I don't see a correlation necessarily. What I was trying to do is capture what the public talked about.
Okay. Is that done?
Some of those issues were things that were brought up at the public hearing, too, by different members, just that you know about employment opportunities for minorities.
Right. Talked about the construction.
Ken Glover talked about that. I mean, these aren't immediate.
They'd all be good things, but they're not something we can do to reduce the jail population.
Why wouldn't the jail population be reduced if they were referred to a mentor or instead of going to jail?
As a diversion.
Or as a reentry.
A pre. Well, because then you're looking at the recidivism stuff, which is the longer term, which Pat was talking about, which I think some of these may have, and we don't know what kind of impact they're going to have on recidivism. But I know without some of these programs, you're going to continue to see recidivism.
Well.
In large numbers.
Well, isn't that what her suggestion was? I mean, she wasn't talking about students at the high school, I assume.
No. She wasn't talking about students at the high school.
So where is she going to find them? Or whose mentoring program is she going to be sending or recommending that they be sent to? I'm confused. I'm not
it wasn't clear.
That's kind of what OIR already claims to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
What about the...
We don't do the hookups anymore.
Do you not?
No.
The one component I know when Mr. Glover was talking about, you know, the construction jobs, why there weren't any minorities in it, it's all kind of the hands-on, learn a vocation. You don't all have to, you know, go to 4 years of college, but learn a vocation, learn a skill so that you can be productive, so that you can try to support yourself. Where does that fit in? I mean, is it like a...
That's what Diane Cohen's trying to do.
So re-entry?
Yeah.
Service referral, maybe? Now that, and who was it? You found out Hammerstone?
I did. I looked on
you found out the Hammerstone, that costs $1,500.
But it's that's the major course. I mean, it's not the one-day thing. It's like a two-week basic carpentry skills. It's pretty intense. That was
Joanne's
thank you. So I just went online and figured out what is the cost for the course, you know.
So that's more of a B under a vocational.
Once you're being released to the program, it doesn't reduce the jail.
I think we're doing a little chicken and egg thing here, too. I think maybe what we need to do is go back and look at everything that people have talked about today and say, if this is going to have an immediate reduction on the jail population. And then there's the issue of may impact recidivism or, you know, a reentry, and they're kind of separate things.
Which is
some
a
are immediate and some are...
I think it might be the A or the B.
If someone, maybe one of you guys, could sort of do a draft version of that that we can react to rather than trying to brainstorm those in a large group.
I think it was hard when we only had a week between the meetings and I was sick, so we couldn't connect and coordinate. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a couple weeks before the next meeting at least. So it would probably give us time to sit down and do that. Bill?
You know, just looking from the outside, looking in, you know, it sounds like a lot of the nexus is around the town justices. So these are gentlemen and ladies who don't necessarily know a lot about the systems and all that kind of stuff. And they work hard to get educated, but they're also just trying to learn how to do their jobs and hone their skills. I think your biggest target of opportunity is what could you do to make a robust ATI in which you would have a very comprehensive set of services really focused in this one place. When I say one place, I don't mean one place. I mean under one umbrella. It could be in various places in the community. But and that way, you know, you're much more likely to have people who know very little about such a system to have greater confidence to refer to it because they could say, oh, this has the ATI seal of approval, it's part of the ATI program, it's been research-based, it's evidence-based, they think it's going to make a difference for jail population and other long-term outcomes. I just think you got a limited amount of money that you're ever going to find for any of this stuff. So this is like, you know, this is like MASH. You know, you're going to focus on the people in the middle that you can help, and the other people, well, God bless them. You know, I that's how, if I was sitting in Mr. Dresser's seat, that's what I'd be saying. Like, okay, boys and girls, please stop. Already names, initials, please stop. Just give me one program I can believe in where lots of different services might exist, and I'll be glad to give that a try.
Well, that's why I printed out the task thing, because that was what my brain went to was, we don't call all of our, we don't have all of our stuff really under one umbrella, but if we were to somehow do that, would that
with the coordinator,
what we're talking about?
To a significant extent, Bill, you just invented probation.
Yeah.
Well, no.
I will make a suggestion because it's 8 o'clock. Deb and I will sit down. We will compile one list. We'll start putting stuff in. We'll start hacking some stuff based on the concepts we talked about. Then we'll have some A, you know, right away stuff that might impact. For example, if we can get the sheriff, you know, so that they can take bail or something like that. And then the B will be the longer term, and then we'll come back, and we will send it out. You guys chew on it. We'll come back and bring it back to another meeting. The final 6 weeks are what I have anticipated to be the hardest. You know, when we start to look at, is it going to be cost-effective? How do we know? We need to figure out how many people we're talking about. How much money will it save? How much money will it cost? That's going to be the nitty-gritty hard part about it.
And if you have other ideas other than what came up today,
right,
of Eric's and Pat's is what I got.
Anything else that
if
we didn't
get
put on
them
here?
To us like ASAP in the next few
got
days.
One more right now.
Great.
Back at our first meeting, there was talk about how the last iteration of this process 10, 15 years ago, there was talk about how corrupt all the justice system statistics are. And a recommendation then that if you clean up the statistics gathering process, we'd have much better data the next time around. And I think what we found when we started this year is that the data is just as corrupt as it was 15 years ago. I think there needs to be a renewed...
What data are you talking about?
A lot of the jail statistics. Joe's been telling me.
They don't jive with what DCJS has.
Or the
DCJS
data that's
is
just not available, right?
Some data is not available. Some of it gets blurry between if somebody was in their pre-sentence and then they were sentenced and stay in. I think there's some pollution in that process.
In sentence versus unsentenced, plus in how, you know, the state captures it, you know, whether it's pretrial or not. Or a lot of DCJS statistics are only as accurate as all the police departments reporting them, which not all of them do.
Right.
But the jail stuff, I mean, I think particularly for the last few years, we thought that was making sense based on what we were seeing. CJATI people,
yes.
Correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a lot of improvement over the last few
right.
years.
3 years.
Right. Right. So I would not call it polluted or tainted, at least the last few years that have been. Yeah,
I wasn't suggesting that persons are corrupt.
It's a bad word.
Yeah, I think that what we were seeing for particularly the last few years of the data was pretty much what we said looked correct.
Well, we've been seeing some data for the last few years, and we didn't
right.
see any data prior
that's
to that.
That's right.
But there's still issues with the data, is what you're saying.
Joe and I have a date later this week, and we'll kind of sum this out.